On this Monday edition of Baseball Barbacast, we are talking about Yusei Kikuchi signing with the Angels, talking about the next stage of the Juan Soto free agency. Offers are coming in. Open up the mailbag, read some of your questions, talk about Jonathan India and Brady Singer being traded for each other, hit some non-tenders, and then give our thoughts on the passing of a Dominican baseball legend, Rico Carty, on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who believes that Game 7 of the World Series should be saved for Thanksgiving afternoon. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and if it goes 7, we wait a month so that the American public can enjoy a winner-take-all with turkey in their tummies.
Instead of the Detroit Lions, who I understand are pretty good this year. So maybe that's not as bad as it was in years past. How are you, Jake?
Lions won again.
The Lions won again. The Tigers are no longer winning again. But GMAT Cash is still pumping out the absolute fire. And you know we are still listening to it, even if we can't name anybody on the lines except for Amon-Ra St. Brown, who's on our fantasy team. Thank you very much. All right, enough football talk, Jake. It's Monday. It's Thanksgiving week. And we have two podcasts coming your way this week. The first one is the one we're recording right now. The second one we'll tell you all about at the end of the show. But Jake Mintz, we have breaking baseball news. And that will be our opener on this Monday edition of Baseball Barbacast. Now, here's what's so exciting about this opener.
Yeah.
Lovely listeners. Jake doesn't know what it is. Now, I love when news breaks before we start recording. This is one of the best. This is the best kinds of news. In fact, way better than the news that breaks after we finish recording. And in this case, while I was, picking up some coffee with my lovely wife before the recording, I hopped on right before we started recording. I said, hey, Jake, are you excited to talk about Yusei Kikuchi, who just signed a contract? And Jake said, what? Who? Yusei Kikuchi? Signed with where?
Yusei Kikuchi?
And so now I get to tell Jake where Yusei Kikuchi signed. Again, this is a bit that we don't intend to always bring back, but this worked out. Jake, how did you miss this, I guess, before I tell you where he signed?
I sat down at my desk this morning at 8 o'clock. I scrolled through MLB trade rumors. Mm-hmm. I read a couple Rico Carty obituaries. I watched old Jose Fernandez highlights. And I added to the show document and just did not open a social media platform.
Uh-huh. Well, as I was sitting waiting for my mocha, I opened up the old tweet machine. I don't know if this news has made it to Blue Sky yet. I'm not sure. I assume it has. But at 8:38 a.m. Eastern time, John Heyman, can you believe it? John Heyman got the scoop for Scott Boras client. More on the Scobo in a second. Yusei Kikuchi has signed a three-year, $63 million deal. First thoughts on three-year, $63 million?
It's a good chunk of change for him.
Good chunk of good change, right?
Getting the third year is a win.
Jake, I'm going to make you guess. Who's the one team that's done anything this winter?
The Los Angeles Angels.
They kept it going as the Angels have signed another player before anybody else has even woken up. The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim have signed Yusei Kikuchi to a three-year, $63 million deal. This comes a few days after. We're going to get to our non-tenders later. They non-tendered Patrick Sandoval, a lefty who's been in their rotation for a while. Now, he had Tommy John surgery last summer, so he was likely not going to be a big factor in their rotation this year. But the Angels stay busy. And Yusei Kikuchi, who was not saddled with the qualifying offer, unlike a lot of the other starting pitchers at the top of this market, is able to get a three-year, $63 million deal. Again, that's a nice chunk of change from an AAV standpoint. A deal that if you told me he got this back in May, I'd be like, what? What happened? Well, he got traded to the Astros and he was fantastic. Now, I know he didn't end up actually starting for the Astros in the postseason, but that wasn't his fault because the Tigers won again. So he was unable to get to face Detroit in what I guess would have been game 3. Instead, he now goes to the Angels, his third American League West club.
Don't hate this move. In fact, kind of like this move. But the Angels picked a fascinating time to start operating intelligently. If you look at the moves that they've made, except for Kyle Hendricks, respectfully, I like these moves, but they're not enough to make the Angels that good, to my opinion. If you took the team they have now and you just put Shohei Ohtani on it, I'd be like, that team's going to make the playoffs. I could talk myself into that.
No, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't. Stop. Don't say that. Come on.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry. We're not allowed to do that. We're not allowed to do that.
They also lost 99 games. Like, okay, I understand what you're saying. I think my takeaway initially, because I agree with the general sentiment that you're starting with, this is the first move, though, that doesn't even feel like these other moves maybe made them incrementally better and showed them like, yeah, they're trying to get veterans. They got Soler and Darno, whatever. This is like a real move. Like, they had to outbid other teams that definitely could have used Yusei Kikuchi to get him to sign before December. I mean, that's what is compelling to me, is that for Kikuchi, who is, again, he's a little bit older. He's 33 already, but coming off this great season, he's been fairly durable. You could say that he got notably better when he started throwing that slider a bunch in Houston, so maybe he can replicate that. This is a much more aggressive move than some of these other moves, picking up players that weren't necessarily going to be super coveted in the way that Darno and Soler were, right? So that's kind of where I'm at, where it does signal to me that they probably got to keep going, right? And I'm curious how much more spending room they actually have, you know, to go. I mean, this brings their payroll. They're still well below the luxury tax line, but I mean, could they still try and land another top 50 hitter or two? Maybe not a top 10 hitter, but it wouldn't surprise me. But it's for a team that was so terrible a year ago, it's going to take a lot more than this for me to get excited. And I will say, it also, you know, they did sign Tyler Anderson after he was an all-star and he was horrible, and then a little bit better in his second year. So hopefully Kikuchi can get them a little bit more than that. Obviously, they're paying him a little bit more than they gave Anderson. So this tells me that, like, there's no turning back now, right? They're not going half measures. Like, they really are going to try and win in 2025. And the reality is, there's no reason for me to give them the benefit of the doubt until they go anywhere close to winning games again. I'm glad they're trying. We are always going to commend baseball teams for trying to win. They're not trying to win. So in that sense, good. Good job. And I like Kikuchi. But again, you just would need so many more moves for me to feel that good about this roster.
This is a great example of how the third wild card changes team behavior in the winter. That extra spot makes the Angels think they could sneak into it. Because when you look at this roster now, if there's only two wild card spots, it's harder to make the argument. But with more room in the playoff field, you could squint and then maybe shut your eyes and dream a little bit, and you could squint and, you know, like, I'm not saying for me. I'm saying for the organization internally. This team right now is trying to compete in 2025. It's like, full stop. Yeah. Now, I don't think they will, but thinking they will is better than not thinking they will internally. This brings their payroll, just for context, to $190 million above the Rangers.
Yeah.
This is a masterclass in bad roster construction. Now, a lot of that is Anthony Rendon sucking up $38.5 million every year of space.
Two more
seats. But still, like, $190 million is well above average in the major leagues.
Oh, yeah.
And this team was absolute buns last year.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, we are glad they're trying. And maybe if you're talking about the third wild card, I think that's valid. If we're really squinting and saying, oh, well, maybe the AL West isn't that good. I mean, they just had this embarrassing season, you know, and maybe the Rangers aren't that good. Maybe the Mariners aren't that good. Maybe the Astros are trading bad. Again, why would we trust the team that has the longest postseason drought, that has all these structural failures and all these things? That's where I'm still at. But again, credit to them for, again, clearly outbidding. You would think there are a lot of teams that would want Yusei Kikuchi without the qualifying offer, and they were able to get him done here before December, which brings us to our last part about this, which is the Scott Boras element. But if you have another Angels thing, go ahead.
I just want to quickly mention Kikuchi has the upside of someone you can trust starting a game one of a playoff series. And those players are hard to find. Now, the Kikuchi that was in Toronto for the first half of last year is someone you wouldn't want starting a playoff game, let alone game one. But once he went over to Houston and made some adjustments, he was amazing. He got a Cy Young vote, okay? Which feels wonky, yes. So I think that when you're the Angels and you're not going to probably spend on Fried or Burns on that top end, you're looking for, if things break 80th percentile with a move, what does it look like? And I think for Kikuchi, he has shown the ability to be dominant in a way that not many pitchers have. Now, the consistency of that and how he rolls it over into next year, he's going to be 34, yada, 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 all fair. But in terms of what the upside of this move is, I like it quite a bit. But sure, let's boot up the Scobo, because Yusei Kikuchi is represented by, yes, Mr. Scott Boris.
Yes, and Scott Boris, you know, he said at the GM meetings, he kind of teased this. He said, this is what he said about Kikuchi when asked about him. Without having a qualifying offer, you see a whole menu of teams that would not normally be participating for a starter at that level. For that reason, he's one of the most sought-after players in free agency, as Jake puts his Boris Corp hat on. A whole menu of teams that apparently include the Angels of Anaheim. Now let's decide, Jake, is this a dub? Because as we stand here, the Scobo, the Scott Boris scoreboard, Scoboed, he is 4-5-2 on the season. We are awarding a win, loss, or draw for anything involving Scott Boris, whether it's a signing, whether it's a bad pun, whether it's someone leaves his agency, as Kyle Raleigh did at the end of last week.
If he falls down a flight of stairs at the winter meetings.
Or like farts in public, that would be an L.
Or if I see him like crushing two brews at the bar at the same time, yeah, like that's a win.
So there's other ways for Scott Boris to win than sign a contract, but this is very straightforward. Did he do well for Yusei Kikuchi here? I think yes. I think for a pitcher to get, you know, over $20 million a year, with Kikuchi's kind of spotty track record before December, is, I think, a nice bit of business. It's a little hard to judge this one because we don't totally know where the starting pitching market is yet. However, I think we're going to give this a dub.
It's the qualifying offer times three, is it not? That's just what the contract is?
Yeah, although now I'm remembering that when we had Jeff Passan on, we were trying to discuss the line for all caps breaking, and I was like, Kikuchi, and you were like, of course. And I believe Jeff said something along the lines of, you said Kikuchi is going to get $80 million, which he did not. But I am still okay giving this a win.
Very quickly, here's why I think it is a win. Now, you could compare it to the Taiwan Walker,
which was a four-year
70 deal. Those guys were younger when they signed the deal.
Yeah, that's why I think I agree. Yep.
That is the thing. Getting a three-year deal for a pitcher who is going to be in his age 34 season, you're paying for 34, 35, 36, and he has never really delivered over the course of a full season.
Yeah, I mean, he was an all-star once with the bad Mariners, or I guess the decent Mariners in 2021. But yeah, we haven't seen the version that we just saw for 10 starts in Houston over a long period. Not even close.
I think this is a Scobo W.
Yeah.
But it's the type of W where, like, it could have gone both ways. You know, it's like 85th minute deflection on a free kick.
Hey, we'll take the points. We will take the points.
Deserved goals is even.
Oh, the X goals. Okay, well, we're going to give the dub, which brings Scott Boris to 5-5-2 on the winter. Boris Corp rolls on. Speaking of Scott Boris, let's move on to Juan Soto. Juan Soto, the reports are, at the start of this week, that the offers will be rolling in. The meetings that we have heard about so far and the teams that have been included, which to our knowledge are Yankees, Mets, Red Sox, Blue Jays, Dodgers, those are the teams that we've heard he has met with. We heard a report that the Blue Jays or that the Phillies wanted to meet with him. I do not believe we have confirmed that he has actually done that.
Matt Gelb of The Athletic wrote at the end of last week, the Phillies have not met with Soto's camp. They are interested.
Got it.
I think Bob Nightingale of USA Today this morning reported that the Phillies have not reached out to Boris Camp yet. And so a meeting with them is not on the books, as it's unrealistic to expect Juan Soto to sign with the Phillies. And so I think, and Nightingale writes this in his piece this morning, we're down to really four teams here, which is Blue Jays, Red Sox, Yankees, and Mets. Mm-hmm. I personally, I'd love to be wrong. I'm going to remove the Blue Jays. It's okay. Kind of how I'm feeling right now. All because right. It just doesn't seem realistic. If they are going to spend that money, they should spend it to keep the amazing Dominican hitter they are already employing, who means something to the city and to the franchise and the fan base. Yes, Juan Soto is better than Vladimir Guerrero Jr. I understand that. It just doesn't seem like the best use of money, and they should extend Vlad. So for me, it is Yankees, Red Sox, and Mets.
I'm with you. I also think that the Blue Jays have the least to sell, and it's not really right. And compared to the other teams, it's going to be the hardest thing to sell. Obviously, there's a price for all these guys, whatever. So, I agree with you. I've been saying extend Vlad for 3 years, so we'll just stay on that. So, Toronto, if you can stick around this conversation, respect, but let's focus on the other three teams.
I'd like to destroy a narrative, if I may. Mm-hmm. Toronto, Canada is an awesome city. Great place. Whenever the Blue Jays come up as a landing spot for a free agent, the term international city is used. New York City is the most international city, maybe in the world.
I think the problem is that this has no reason to dispel that Toronto is an international city. It's that it's not the only one. The way that it's talked about is like, right, that's my issue with it.
International for us because we live in America.
Okay, I understand.
Listen,
I know your point. Yes. No, but again, I think it's more that it's used as like, well, it's internet. It's like, yeah, but it's not the only one. And one of the other big ones is a lot more relevant to this conversation.
Also, it made more sense for Ohtani because the international that Juan Soto would care about would be Dominicans in theory. And there are
more of those in New York and Boston than in Toronto.
Well, that's the thing. The biggest Dominican populations in the states are Massachusetts and New York.
So like, I will say, I hope, and as Jeff Paston kind of alluded to, there is a path to a positive offseason for the Blue Jays that doesn't involve Juan Soto. I do believe that. Yeah. You extend Vlad, you sign a couple of big free agents, and you have a good enough roster that you go for it again in 25. Great. Okay. Let's move them to the side for now. These three teams that we still have, I want to hit on the Red Sox here, okay? Because they, at the very, before we even started getting anything, the inclination from most of us because of the last few years is to just be like, ha-ha, Red Sox, that's not going to happen. But now, not just because they've already met with him, but because of everything that's kind of coming out of Red Sox world is that they are not messing around. When you have Sam Kennedy, the president, speaking at the owners' meetings, being like, not the, you know, the half-hearted full throttle that obviously no one believed and then everybody laughed at. I mean, the quotes that Sam Kennedy is giving publicly being like, there is extreme urgency to challenge for a division. We are trying to win 95 games, even if it takes us over the luxury tax. We don't care. We are trying to win multiple divisions. We are trying to win multiple World Series. And then you have David Ortiz coming out publicly being like, yes, like this is the time. Juan Soto needs to be a Red Sox. I can help make that happen. I believe that the Red Sox have finally understood that like it is all about going for it, going for it, going for it. This is not to say that it is going to happen, but, you know, they sure are going for it here. And I do believe they are going to be putting their best foot forward. Now, we'll find out because this week we will be getting the offers and we'll see how serious they really are if we actually end up getting those real, you know, numbers. But the Red Sox are absolutely a real character to be taken seriously here.
You know what Teddy Roosevelt didn't say? Speak loudly and carry a small stick. The Red Sox can talk a big game all they want, but until they act, I will not believe them. Last winter, they said full throttle and then didn't really do that much. Move in silence, okay? And then strike. I understand that the organization is trying to placate the fan base by being like, don't lose your minds. We're going to do stuff. I promise we're going to do stuff. Guess what? Just do stuff. And then they'll be fine later. You don't need to make them feel better right now. That's not changing anything. When you sign Juan Soto, if you do, people will then buy season tickets and you'll be okay.
Yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. You don't need to come out, in my opinion. I appreciate any level of clarity. I get it. But when you're doing this for a fan base that you have misled in previous winters, I think that it is a dangerous game. Because guess what? You can just get outbid on all of these guys. There is a chance. That could happen to you. In fact, I feel confident saying you're probably not going to get Juan Soto. Look, you might end up with Max Fried and Alex Bregman and move Fravi Devers to first and trade Tristan Cassis for a good reliever. Like, sure.
We're not trading Tristan Cassis, but yes.
You're promising the world. Yes. You're promising the world here to a very hungry fan base. Yeah. And I think it's just,
I'm with you. I'm just super compelled by it because you would think that they would take the opposite tact of like, we are going to be going all out behind the scenes and then the fans will be extra excited when we do deliver on some amount of them, right? Because in what you just described, in the world that you just described, the strategy that you just described as more optimal, if they did sign Fried and Bregman, people are thrilled, you know? If they never even would have considered Juan Soto as a possibility, then they're thrilled. But now we're getting to the point where it's like, wait a minute. Is Juan Soto going to sign with the Red Sox? So we'll see. We'll see. They're going to try. As we've said, they have the money. No disputing that.
Real G's move in silence like Anthopoulos. Okay, so the next two teams that we need to mention are the Yankees and the Mets. And we've talked about this again and again and again and again. We won't be talking to you about Juan Soto until next week. And in the event that we get more news here this week during Thanksgiving, we just want to make sure everyone is prepared. Here's where I'm at right now, okay? There is no ceiling for Steve Cohen, Mets owner. The money is fake. Money in sports, in baseball, is only as important from a team-building perspective. It is only as important as what it allows or restricts you from doing, okay? Now, some of that restriction is self-inflicted and self-imposed, I understand. There is no ceiling for Steve Cohen. He is the 80-whatever-th richest person on the spinning ball we live on, okay? So if he wants to give Juan Soto $780 million, it's monopoly money to him, right? If he really wants Juan Soto, he will get Juan Soto at the end of the day. I have swung back around this winter between these two teams, and then I rewatched the movie Dumb Money, which is about the GameStop short in which Steve Cohen is a character. And I was like, this guy just does what he wants and they're going to get Juan Soto.
Yeah, I mostly agree with you. I think I'll just say ahead of this week and as we start getting news about the offers, again, I don't have much to add to what you just said because that's generally where I've landed. I'm very curious about if we start getting interesting structures, if we start hearing things about reports about opt-outs, does Juan Soto need an opt-out? Of course not, because what does he need to prove? It's not like he needs a pillow contract. But however, maybe there is a situation where Juan Soto, for whatever reason, doesn't want to commit somewhere for 15 years. And he would like, you know, an opt-out after 3 or 5 or 6 or whatever, right? And so the structures, let alone deferrals, who knows if that comes into play. Because so much of this has just been like, all right, how many years, how many dollars? And yes, that's still ultimately going to be the biggest question. But I'm curious as we start getting into the negotiating stage of this is, do we start getting creative? And maybe that's where the Dodgers come in. They're like, here, Juan Soto, here's 3 years and $180 million. You know, like maybe that's basically what they try with Harper. You know, maybe they try that with Juan Soto. Who's to say? The last thing I'll say about this, as we kind of set the stage for this next part of this process, I feel like this might get done before the winter meetings. Now, the winter meetings this year are later than they were a year ago. So we're already going to be farther in the calendar than we were by the time we arrive at the winter meetings. But if we're getting offers this week, if that's accurate, you know, ahead of Thanksgiving, feels like this could, again, it's so hard to tell with this because to your point, the bidding could, in theory, just go into outer space. Like, I don't know when that someone's going to tap out. I mean, it might just be when Steve Cohen is done, when all the other teams are like, oh, well, can't match what Steve Cohen's offering. And then that's the end of it. I don't know. It kind of feels like we're wrapping this up before the winter meetings, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but I could be wrong.
Let's take a break. And when we get back, we'll crack open the mailbag and talk about Brady Singer. And welcome back to the Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mitz, Jordan Schusterman. Let's open the mailbag.
BaseballBarbercast@gmail.com. That's how you reach us. And we've got a few emails that we would like to read. Jake, where would you like to begin?
Our first one is from Brad. I've been saying this question all summer as it doesn't warrant time during the regular season, but the cold months demand it to be pondered. How effective would a major league pitcher be if they were forced to throw with the alternate arm? Part of me wants to think that the absolute dogs like Max Scherzer would still be able to rack up some Ks with their left arm through sheer will alone. But let's say the current version of Patrick Corbin were to face off against prime Jake Mintz, both throwing with their right hand. Would it be an even matchup? Part of me has got to assume it would be more favorable to have a position player on the mound than a lefty Gerrit Cole. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
So I think this is one of the great just questions about athleticism in general. It's so random and unpredictable. You hear these rumors like, oh, here, look, this guy can throw left-handed bullpens, right? Darvish, we've seen throw lefty and look very natural. But I'm sure there's a large percentage of major leaguers that look just as goofy as we do. And I just have really no way of telling who those are. Like, I don't know if Patrick Corbin, just because he's one of the worst pitchers, is also one of the worst right-handed pitchers. That doesn't really logically make sense to me. Sure, I could try to apply grace and athleticism and, like, who seems like someone that could do it. You know, like, Tyler Glasnow seems like someone that is, like, athletic and gifted enough to throw left-handed, but I could be totally wrong. So I just, this is such a hard thing to project that I love the question, but I really don't know.
Spencer Strider feels like he throws 92 with his left arm, right?
But to Brad's point, I think I agree with him that I think, yes, I would absolutely rather have the average major league position player that can just chuck it in there at 85 because they're a major leaguer.
This is the thing. Peak Jake Mintz, me at my best as a player, would be better than 98% of major league pitchers throwing with their offhand. Me with my onhand against them with their offhand, I would be better. And I'm not just saying this like I was not that good.
Like, no, I mean, to your point,
I'd still get crushed.
It's hard for me to disagree just because, like I said, I have no idea how many big leaguers are. Like, are big leaguers actually that much better at doing things with their opposite hand? Maybe, but I don't know.
No, because they... Okay, so why is... Thinking of an example, Corbin Burns' right arm worth $200 million. Mm-hmm. Because over the last 30 years, he has slowly been building up his right arm. He is coordinated when he moves in that direction. He has done it again and again and again. Part of the reason Yu Darvish can do it lefty is because he probably did it as a kid. If you ask Corbin Burns to throw a ball with his left hand, he would be an average middle school pitcher. He would, like, that's my take.
But my point is, I don't know that. Like, Darvish, we just happen to know because, again, there have to be other major leaguers who are probably more coordinated and physically gifted on average that are able to do this. But I do think that there's a huge percentage of them that, yeah, would look just as goofy. So to your point, Which brings us back to, yes, take the random position player because they can still throw harder than most normal people. Like,
we should do this at spring training.
Yeah. Does this qualify? This is a great, like, on the line, like, would teams be uncomfortable with this from an injury risk standpoint? I think still yes. But here's the thing, though. I think we would learn a lot just by having them even play catch, let alone, like, here, go try and air it out and throw as hard as you can. Like, you wouldn't even have to ask that to learn a lot about the average major leaguer throwing with the wrong hand. So, honestly, I think we should just, like, text a bunch of the players that we know and ask them how bad they are at this, and we'll get back to you, Brad. Brad, thank you for your question. It's a very good one.
Our next question is from Harrison. Harrison says, should baseball add enforcers like hockey?
Thank you, Harrison. I'm sure you're listening. What position is the enforcer?
Backup catcher. Next question.
how does the enforcer enforce? Because when we talk about enforcing stupid baseball unwritten rules, it's normally like the pitcher. But I guess the catcher could be the one. I mean, the catcher certainly has opportunities to enforce.
Okay.
What are some other, like, outfielders cannot enforce. Let's just get that out of the way, right?
They're bystanders.
First baseman could enforce. I mean, you're probably risking an ejection, but like you could probably get away with like a hard tag as a first baseman on like a ball up the line. That would be an enforcing scenario.
Your first question is your best one. What are you enforcing? You are enforcing the morality of the sport and the culture therein. Okay. You are administering justice within a baseball context. And the people who get to do that are low-level relievers that come into the game to throw balls at the butts of the other team's best player. Now, do we agree with this as a strategy? No. But this is what enforcement is in baseball. And so I think that the closest thing we have to an enforcer is honestly friend of the show, Brent Honeywell Jr. If you need someone to come in and throw at someone's back, like that's like Brent will probably do that, right?
But I guess like what you're describing as the role of the baseball enforcer is different. Like I'm trying to apply the hockey enforcer to baseball.
But we don't do that as often. Like
I know. It's funnier to me if we do.
Every team's bench clears probably on average once a year, maybe 1.5.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so for those, whenever the bench is clear, 98% of the time, people are just like rubbing their shoulders up against one another.
They're all the hold me back guys.
I would just get a team of peacekeepers to keep my guys not suspended. Now, I think having an enforcer in the dugout whose job it is to run out of the field and freaking clock someone in the face, that is detrimental to your team. Whereas in hockey, it is beneficial to your team.
I want to go down the hockey road a little bit more, and then we'll do one or two more emails. So enforcer has its own Wikipedia page on hockey, just enforcer ice hockey. Okay, enforcer is a role in ice hockey, term sometimes used synonymously with fighter, tough guy, or goon. An enforcer's job is to deter and respond to dirty or violent play by the opposition. When such play occurs, the enforcer is expected to respond aggressively by fighting or checking the offender. Enforcers are expected to react particularly harshly to violence against star players or goalies. But then, this is interesting, and then it says, enforcers are different from pests. Do you know what a pest is?
a pest is like a guy who's like always fouling and like pissing people off.
There you go. A pest is a player who attempts to antagonize opponents either by physical play or verbal incitement. So that's interesting that those are slightly different things, right? The enforcer is trying to defend the star players, and then the antagonist is more of like the pest is more like the Patrick Beverly type of just like trying to get under your skin, which that does sort of exist in baseball, I would say. That's like Jose Caballero is in the pest, not an enforcer. Definitively.
Do you remember Donald Brashear with the Caps? Like, he was an enforcer.
There you go. So anyway, maybe we're showing our lack of hockey knowledge, but I enjoy this. I think that, again, you could apply it in different ways, because I agree with you that what we are enforcing in baseball is different than what we're enforcing in hockey. But it's a good question. Thank you to Harrison, my dear friend, Harry. Thank you for emailing, even though you don't listen to the podcast. I appreciate you. Who's next?
Our next email is from Calvin. Kalman says, hey guys, with all of the Paul Skeens pictures during the offseason, winning rookie of the year and everything, do you not see the Chris Bryant in him? I didn't notice until he grew the beard to go with the mustache, but I swear they're the same person. And I feel like I'm going insane because I haven't seen anyone else talk about it. Calvin. Well, Calvin, you sent this email on November 18th. And the next day when Paul Skeens won the award, on the MLB Instagram post, Brock Holt commented, that's Chris Bryant.
Yeah. So there's your validation, Calvin. And also, I also hadn't thought about this because we haven't seen Paul Skeens with a beard. It's not really that complicated. We just haven't really seen this version of him really at all. So I don't think it's like spot on, but I do think with the beard, with the right angle, it's nice. you know, it's nice. Chris Bryant is so irrelevant now. It's nice to find ways to have Chris Bryant be relevant. I'm glad we're remembering.
Chris Bryant had elite eyes. I guess he still has them in his head.
See, and again, we're talking about him in the past tense. Dude's still got like how many years left on his rookie's contract? But yeah, no, it's true. Chris Bryant, it is kind of underselling Chris Bryant. Like, Paul Skeens had developed a look with the mustache. So it seems weird to be applying another look to him.
He's going to have the mustache back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially because I think Spencer Strider might go away from the mustache.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. Is that a scoop?
Because he went away from it at the end of 2023. Okay. He was full beard in the playoffs, if I remember correctly. Oh, and so I think that might be Skeens's to take. Okay. We'll see how Strider returns in 2024. One more question here, and this is from Jake.
Oh, Jake. Okay.
There's no text in the email. It's just a subject line. One question. Oh,
lazy emailer.
And it says, what's the best time of the baseball season to die? So I was thinking about this. I mean, Jake was thinking about this. On Saturday night, I was out with some buddies, and the idea of dying in the middle of the baseball season, we're talking about mortality. And the idea of dying in the middle of the season really bummed me out, because you wouldn't get to know who won. Like, I really want to die in the winter so that I'm good. So, but then if you die in the winter, it's like, where's Soto going to sign? You don't get to know. Now, maybe if you have certain beliefs in the afterlife and it's like, oh, well, if I go there, like, I'll get to know all the news. So my question for you is, Jordan, when is the best and worst time to expire given the baseball calendar?
So I think if we're going in season, you want to go as early as possible. I think you want to have like the joy of opening day still. But you don't want to get too far into the season where you're like, feel like you actually know anything. So I think like late April is a good option. You got the whole off season. You got to see new players with their new teams, and you got opening day.
Unanswered mystery, because in June, it's like, man, can the Nats really do this? Whereas later in April, it's all fake.
All the standings mean nothing in April. So it's like, I don't take anything away from it.
Can I offer?
Yeah, do you have another one?
I think another great time to die would be like March 12th, like right after your birthday.
Okay, yeah.
Because that's when spring training starts to stink.
Yeah.
And you don't have any unanswered mysteries, right?
Unless Blake Snell is still a free agent.
There's also like who's on what teams by then.
Yeah.
There's an argument that like right before spring training.
Oh, those weeks in February. I don't know. To me, it's like I want to be looking forward to, depends on if I'm planning this out. Like, I know it's coming to an end here. You know, yeah, we do end, I think, April. I feel good about my April. So now what about worse? Let's do that, and then let's take a break.
I mean, I think there's a lot of good picks. A lot of bad times.
Here's one for this past season. Mookie Betts is coming up to the plate in the fifth inning of the World Series Game 5.
Yeah, bad time to die.
Ah, there you go. Oh, I wonder what happened. What happened next?
Well, that's when the Yankees' dreams died at the same time. So I think the obvious pick here, right, is before Game 7 of the World Series, right? Like, to me, the suspense of it all would be a bummer, because you're really missing out on a historic game. Like, if we had Yankees-Dodgers Game 7 and you don't get to watch that, that stinks. However, I think the best answer is, like, the day off between the regular season and the playoffs. Like, that's the worst.
Which is funny, because that's when we vote on awards. So it's like we move on to the afterlife known as the postseason, where we are supposed to, you know, not know anything that happens after that.
Underrated good time to die might actually be right after the Home Run Derby, so you don't have to watch the All-Star game.
Yeah, depends on but I can't do that. Wait, Jake. Why can't I do? Why can't that be my pick? And then we'll see how well you know me. And then we'll take a break.
Why can't that be your pick?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Tuesday? What's on Tuesday? Day three of the draft.
Day three of the draft.
All right, Missy, kidding me? I don't care about the All-Star game, but day three of the draft. You want me to? That'd be talk about nightmare.
Tragic.
All right, anyway. Email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. We're going to take
let
a quick break.
Let us know when you want to die.
Yeah, jeez. All right.
Within the baseball season.
We will be right back to wrap up our show. We'll be right back. Thank you. baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Email us. Bye. Back in a second.
And we're back here on Baseball Barbacast, reborn, you might even say. We have a trade.
Yes.
Wow.
This was probably going to be earlier in the show, before Yusei Kikuchi upstaged it. On Friday night, Jonathan India of the Cincinnati Reds and Brady Singer of the Kansas City Royals were traded for each other, and Joey Weimer was thrown in there just for fun. This was a trade we already contemplated because it was reported a week before it actually happened. By two very good reporters, Ken Rosenthal and C. Trent Rosecrans, they were like, Reds and Royals discussing Jonathan India for Brady Singer trade. I like the idea that they were like truly about to make the trade, and then they were like, damn, they got us. We got to pretend like we weren't about to make that trade, and then we got to add Joey Weimer, so it looks like we weren't doing this all along.
I like the opposite, which is C. Trent and Ken Rosenthal were wrong.
They gave them the idea.
And the Reds and Royals were like,
whoa, wait a minute. This lines up quite nicely. Either way, that is very, very, very funny. So yes, Brady Singer and Jonathan India have indeed been traded for each other. Now, if you just focus on the players, this is certainly compelling as these two were teammates at the University of Florida for 3 years. They were both first round picks in the 2018 draft. When you first saw this, again, it's baseball trade, right? One need for this need. Who, just instant reaction where you're like, I like this more for the who?
The Reds.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. I think finding players to suck up that many innings is hard. I think the Reds have needed that greatly and have struggled to find people to do that. Now, Grant, you can't like copy their 2024 injury bug into 2025 and assume it's going to continue, but you can never have too many innings, right? I just don't love this for the Royals. I think India as a offensive player, his profile fits pretty well in that he gets on base and the Royals need that. I just don't think he fills a void for them. I think that Michael Garcia has showed enough that he should be the everyday third baseman still. And I think Michael Massey showed enough that he should be the everyday second baseman. And I think that this team needs outfield help. That is the hole on the roster. And India doesn't fill that hole. Now, there's a chance that they take India and they want him to play left, or they have Massey working left. I understand you're currently looking at Michael Garcia's numbers from last year and you're shaking your head and you're grimacing. I just think that there's still a good player in there, an everyday average big leaguer. And I just think that this does not solve a problem for them. India's a good player. He's an average big leaguer who can help them and raises the floor for them. I just don't think that he's changing the story of the 2025 Royals, if that makes sense.
Yes, you could still argue they needed him more than they needed Brady Singer. I see what you're saying. I want to believe that Michael Garcia definitely can be that, but to me, he was bad enough to where I am not 100% sure that was the case. And maybe India ends up DHing more. Is that the best use of him? I don't know. I think that they do just need more above average hitters, above average on base guys, especially we're talking about on base. That is a strength of India that is clearly a massive weakness for Michael Garcia. I hope that Garcia can develop into a good player. I do believe that Michael Massey is a good player, so I'm with you on that. I think I like this about even. I do think that the people kind of scratching their head about this for Cincinnati, I think you nailed it. I think that Brady Singer raises the floor for this rotation in a very good way, and the fact they got Nick Martinez back as well should help them. The problem with that is this Reds offense now is like just stunningly and concerningly thin. And even if we just plop Matt McClain back in there at second base, and I'm the biggest Matt McClain believer, but he just missed an entire season. I hope he's awesome when he comes back. That's a lot to expect from him. They have to add on the offensive side multiple guys. And obviously, that's not a team that's coming off the postseason. So in that sense, I'm more inclined to trust what Kansas City is doing here than Cincinnati. I do think that Kansas City should dip back into the free agent pool among the starting pitchers, because now, beyond the three of Reagan's, Lugo, Waka, it's a little sketchy. But if they can replace that with a mid-tier free agent, I do think that their offense got better with India. So I like it a little bit more for Kansas City, assuming they can make a few more moves, because I think that there's less work to be done with Kansas City, whereas Cincinnati, I'm like, all right, we have more work to be done here with this position player group.
The thing that I don't like about it for Kansas City right now has nothing to do with Jonathan India. It is that lineup, when we watched it in October, fall to the Yankees, it was like, oh my God, they need someone else who bangs. They just need someone who bangs. And to have any of the DH plate appearances be given to Jonathan India or Michael Massey, guys who can go play the field, when like Jock Peterson, who is a one-dimensional slugger, who, I mean, no one fits well in that ballpark, but like, you can get a dude who can't play defense, who hits the baseball hard all the time, and put them in that spot. And that's what this team needs more than anything else.
Yeah. And I do wonder if it is just going to be more Salvi at DH, because we know Freddie Freeman is at the very least an awesome defensive catcher. That is maybe your best lineup. But I agree with you. Again, still questions on both these rosters. I just think that India does help their offense a good bit, even if the defensive fit is a little bit awkward. Let's move on to the non-tenders. Let's do this quickly.
We can really
it's this simple. Like,
who are the three non-tendering one more time?
Yeah. So on Friday, players that were arbitration eligible, teams could decide on Friday, we are not interested in having you on our roster anymore, and they can clear whatever they were projected to be paying them and immediately make them free agents. This is an interesting, this, you know, adds a couple dozen free agents to the market kind of later on in this free agent process. And there's always a handful of recognizable names. How many of these guys will be impact players in 2025? Probably not very many, but there's at least a couple here that I'm sure will be getting, you know, major league deals of reasonable consequence.
Is this team of non-tenders the worst team in baseball?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I was going to ask you the same thing. We don't need to do the full starting nine, but if you sketch it out, it is definitely the worst one. Most recognizable names that we get, we have two, you know, familiar closers over the last few years, Kyle Finnegan and Jordan Romano. Romano, a lot of health questions. Kyle Finnegan was just really, just basically has just gotten worse every month that he's been the Nationals closer, but has racked up a lot of saves. If Romano's healthy, I mean, he was good when he was last healthy, but he hasn't been healthy recently.
Saves make pitchers very expensive in arbitration. Yes. And so I think Romano was projected to earn like $8.5 million.
Yeah.
Finnegan, I think, was around $6 million. And so it just wasn't worth it for those teams based upon where their budgets are at right now. As far as position players go, to me, the most notable ones are Connor Joe, who has been like an everyday player for the Pirates over the last couple seasons.
But
represents that they don't really want to pay for anything. I'm not.
Well, and also I'm saying an everyday player for the Pirates is respectfully not that good of a player.
I think Connor Joe is a useful bench piece for a good team. Sure. Nick Madrigal, who was the number 3 overall pick by the White Sox, traded to the Cubs for Craig Kimbrell. Wow, I feel old. And then just has never hit for any type of impact. The Cubs non-tendered him. And then I think Mike Tauchman surprised me.
Cubs non-tendering him. Has been above average, like very useful. I mean, he's just been totally exactly what they wanted him to be the last few years.
And this is a consequence of Cody Bellinger opting in. If the Cubs had been able to trade Bellinger last week before this deadline, they would have kept Tauchman. But at the current point in time, he just doesn't fit with the roster construction. And that's unfortunate. And I am just, man, the Cubs make me mad. Before we get out of here, one more topic. I want to briefly talk about Rico Cardi, who passed away over the weekend at the age of, I believe, 85. Rico Carty was not the first Dominican player in the major leagues. He was not even the first Dominican superstar in the major leagues, but he was an absolutely vital player to the early days of Dominican baseball. He won a batting title with the Atlanta Braves in the 1960s. Sorry, excuse me, 1970. And was just a very unique player. The great book I read a couple years ago called Eastern Stars about the history of baseball on the eastern part of the island in the Dominican Republic. Rico Carty was the first superstar to come from San Pedro de Macorís, which is not the capital of the Dominican, which is the city towards the east where a lot of the sugarcane production is from. And he, even more specifically, he was from a town called Consuelo, which is about a 20-minute drive north of San Pedro. And I went in 2019 and ran like a camp, like a coaching camp for kids in Consuelo. And you just, like, Rico Carty is God. Like, there's just pictures of him everywhere. Now, Consuelo and San Pedro over the years have developed more big leaguers proportionately per capita than any other place in the world, really. And so, you know, there, Sammy Sosa is a big deal there, and there are all these other names that you'd recognize, but it starts with Rico Carty. Mm-hmm. And my favorite tidbit from him, and this is in the book Eastern Stars, is that he got really good at hitting the ball up the middle as a kid because they would play in the street. And if you hit it to the houses, it was an out. So, like, the bases would be on the edges of the street and you would run it in like a diamond, obviously. But if you pulled it too far and it hit a house, you were out. And so he got really good at hitting the ball up the middle over and over and over again. So rest in peace to Rico Carty, a true Dominican baseball legend. I played winter ball down there for, I think, 21 years.
Yes.
A lot of it with the local team, Estrellas Orientales. Mm-hmm. And they're like, these are the types of players who I'm happy the internet exists, mm-hmm. right? To educate dumb gringos like us.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I just would have to, you know, I don't know, go to the library or something.
Yes. Now, as you said, one of the original Dominican stars in the, you know, debuting in 63. But I mean, it's a hell of a career. And you mentioned his time in the Dominican Winter League, a league that has so much history. And Estrellas Orientales, you know, they won a walk-off home run on Sunday, which you could kind of tell it was one of those moments where at home, like, the fans there, it's one of the more unique atmospheres. Of course, I know you got to experience that of all the Dominican stadiums. You know, you have to imagine they had shown, like, done a whole Rico Carty thing on the broadcast, like, right before the ninth inning. And then Willie Rosario, walk-off home run for Estrellas. So I recommend going and checking out the video I retweeted of that Estrellas walk-off on Sunday. All right, that's it. We will be back later this week on Wednesday with a special Thanksgiving Travel Day episode with a special guest. It's our annual tradition. The 2024 Time Capsule episode is coming on Wednesday. If you don't know what that is, you're going to find out on Wednesday. We are looking forward to it. So thank you to producer Andrew Hartz. Thank you, Jake Mintz. You can email us baseballbarbcast@gmail.com. And we will talk to you all later this week.